This episode of Ask a Biologist is being pulled from our special collections that have been stored in our secret vault. This is Ask a Biologist, a program about the living world, and I'm Dr. Biology. Today we have a tale of living dinosaurs, but not the type of dinosaurs that you might be thinking about. Instead, these are the dinosaurs of the termite world, a story of war and change, colonies battling colonies, and workers changing into kings and sometimes queens and other times even a soldier. Our guest today is Barbara Thorne, professor and the director of Biological Sciences Graduate Program at the University of Maryland. She's been studying termites and the really interesting world that they live in. Some of these colonies, when they meet each other, the battles begin. Barbara, I want to thank you for joining us on Ask a Biologist. It's wonderful having you here.
Thank you.
Now, for some of the regular listeners of Ask a Biologist, I know they're wondering, why is it they're always talking about insects, and why are they often social insects? And they just don't realize that we actually have one of the best social insect groups at Arizona State University. And the other reason is, well, there are a lot of insects out there. And if you're going to study something in the living world, especially in the animal kingdom, you know, geez, you know, this could be really cool stuff, right? So that's one of the reasons why we have a lot of people that do this. You study termites. Now, my question is, why termites?
Dr. Biology, I think you set that up really well. So why do people study insects and why do so many people study social insects? And when you actually look at all the different insects in the world, it turns out that the social insects are a huge group of them. Like, they dominate all the other types of insects. So right there, social insects, there's something about that very interesting organization that has made them very, very successful and very diverse, and they're in many different types of habitats, and they're very important in those habitats. Termites, for example, are ultra cool because they are responsible for, say, tropical rainforests.
Okay.
Now, you wouldn't think that, right?
Tropical rainforest, termites. They wouldn't go side
by
side.
They don't go side by side. And yet, when you think about it, so you think about a tropical rainforest, oh, how cool. There's monkeys in the trees, and there's great big tall trees, and there's vines all around, and monkeys using those vines to swoop like Tarzan and whatever. All this just incredible diversity and huge flowers. But all of that vegetation, all of that green stuff, the trees and the plants, are sucking up nutrients from the soil. And so even though you see a tropical rainforest looks really lush, in fact, it's hurting. In the soil, the nutrients are gone. And so they rely on the termites to recycle. The termites are the ace recyclers in the whole planet when it comes to plants.
Oh, so they're the green machines out
there.
They
are. That's a great term. That's a great term. So when a storm comes through and knocks down a big tree and it pulls vines and all this like drama from the plants and they die. But then the termites march in and the termites are able to digest dead wood or dead plants of any type. And that's rare. There aren't too many animals that can do that. And termites do it quickly. And then all those nutrients from the plant are put back into the soil and new plants can grow. So termites are really, really important for that. They're important where we live up here in the United States for aerating the soil. They hang around in the soil and they're digging around and moving things around, and that helps the roots of plants get oxygen and so they grow better. So anyway, for all sorts of reasons, termites are cool. And why do I study them? Well, for those reasons, and because they're important in our houses. We don't want them there. We want them in the tropical rainforest. We don't want them in our houses. And then another aspect of termites and why I got in to study them in the first place is what you also talked about, that social insects are so common. And lots of people know about a honeybee, the honeybee queen, and flying off the new swarms and the honey and, you know, the workers and the drones and ants, they're all over. And wasps, well, let's not talk about wasps too much. They sting in there, but they're really, really interesting insects. And those are all kind of cousins. They're closely related. And they all have these amazing social systems with a queen and workers that help the queen and stay in the colony. And then there's another major group of insects that has that same kind of really elaborate social organization, and that's the termites. But the termites are a very, very different group of insects. And so this is a case where we call it convergent evolution, that two very, very separate types of beasts, in this case the ants and bees and wasps on the one hand and termites on the other hand, have, for totally separate lineages, they've developed a very similar colony organization and life organization. So you have a queen termite and you have a queen honeybee, and you have lots and lots of workers with the termites, and you have lots and lots of workers with the honeybees, and foraging for new food and soldiers, and in the case of termites, you've got the king, and really neat stuff. So that is engaging, and as biologists, we always like to ask the big questions. Kids are always curious, and it's great to ask questions. Don't worry about whether they're good questions or bad questions. You know, if you're curious about it, that's a good thing, and ask the question. So how these complex social systems evolve that are social insects, that's a big question.
And an interesting thing for you is you've been studying what happens when two separate colonies of termites actually find each other. You know, they bump into each other, they're on a tree, trees are really big, been a long time not seeing each other, but all of a sudden they come in contact. And it's an interesting story. It's kind of that tale of battles and wars and kings and the queens are ousted. You actually showed a really neat illustration, and it was a chessboard. And I like that. Can we talk a little bit about that? Because it illustrates what you were talking
about.
It
does. It's an amazing illustration, very clever, and it was done by a National Science Foundation artist named Zina Duretsky. And what it depicts is the two teams on a chessboard. So you've got the different players on the chessboard, and one of them is the queen. And the queen, she's moved to the other side of the board, and when she gets there, she's replaced by a pawn, and the pawn becomes the new queen. And that is what's happening in natural situations with termites, that you start out with two teams, just like in chess, and the two colonies, two little termite families, when they meet, the queen is assassinated.
Whoa.
Yeah. Wow. Drama.
Yeah.
And then one or more of the workers in the termite colony, kind of like the pawns in the chess game, they replace the queen and they become the new egg layers and do the duties that the queen did before she was assassinated. So we've been looking at that as a model for what might have happened when termites first evolved, which was a long time ago, 130, 140 million years ago.
That's a million with a big M, okay.
It is. So if I had a time machine, that's where I'd be, going back and seeing what was actually happening. And I wish I could do that. Maybe in the future we'll be able to do that. But right now, the best we can do is to look at the termites that are alive now that have retained some of the characteristics of their ancient ancestors. And that's what has sparked this study, is looking at the modern termites.
I think you even call them modern dinosaurs.
Yeah, they're sort of the dinosaurs of living termites. That's how I sort of think about them. But actually, termites evolved a long time ago, the late Jurassic, early Cretaceous. There were lots of dinosaurs around, probably eight termites.
So we know the why you might be studying them, so we can answer some questions about evolution. In fact, this was something that Darwin was having a little bit of a problem with.
Absolutely. Darwin wrote his manuscript for his key book on the origin of species, including a section on social insects, but it troubled him because the kicker for Darwin was his whole theory was based on the theory of evolution by natural selection, that the winners in the evolutionary game are those who actually produce offspring for the next generation. And he knew that honeybees were out there who didn't reproduce, that the worker honeybees were sterile. And that was kind of a showstopper for him. And instead of sweeping it under the rug, he kind of parked his whole big book manuscript in a drawer for close to 20 years. And that was one of the reasons. He couldn't figure out the social insects. He wondered if they were an exception to his whole theory.
Right, because there was a long delay between his travels on the Beagle and actually publishing this manuscript.
That's right. And one of the reasons that he delayed was the social insects, which, again, we come back to asking big questions. And this is something that still interests evolutionary biologists, is the evolution of sterile members of social insect colonies, which is, turns out to be most of the colony. So how did sterility evolve? And it's still a very contentious subject. We'd love to hear Darwin's current opinion about it, and I think he'd be very, very excited by all the work that's been done.
Right, and it's the thing about science. It's always changing. We're learning more things. We reevaluate what we've learned before, and that's why, you know, we need more scientists.
Absolutely. And, you know, a lot of people get intimidated by, oh, there's so much to learn, and, you know, what if I make a mistake? And those sorts of fears are natural. But the cool thing about science is that if you get interested in whatever, be it termites or outer space or microbes or whatever, and you really start learning about it, you become an expert pretty quickly. So you just pick one topic of snakes or something, and you could learn a lot about them that the kid next door doesn't know. So already you're kind of an expert. And that's really how, when you get serious about science, you dive into something and you don't worry about the mistakes, because we all make mistakes and we continue to make mistakes. But that's actually how you learn, by making a mistake and then you realize, oh, that's, you know, that's for this reason, and then you kind of get it. It does seem intimidating. There is a lot to learn, but it's also logical and it's fun. And the super fun part is that you're making new discoveries.
Well, it's not unlike some of the very complex computer games today. If you start out at level 10, you'll never get anywhere. So you usually start out maybe a level before level 1 that teaches you how the game works, and then you go 1, 2, 3, and it gets more and more complex. Not unlike science.
A great analogy.
So, and again, with games and science, if you like what you're doing, you know, time goes by. It's amazing how fast you learn things and you learn techniques. So how did you get started with termites?
So I got excited about termites for the same reason that Darwin was interested in social insects. This whole idea of how did they evolve? What was the driving force that led to these complex societies? And there were lots and lots of people studying ants, bees, and wasps. So I thought, well, there's a lot of people on that level and playing the game, and I'll just go back to the first level but do termites, where there's fewer people, and yet it's a very exciting system.
When you got started, did you figure that you were going to be doing research for this long on termites?
You know, honestly, I had a feeling I would. I was the kind of thing that it felt like a good fit for me, but I have had the privilege of doing a wide variety of studies with termites. So it hasn't just been one thing, which is another way to have a wonderful career in science. But what I've been able to do is to travel many different places in the world and work on a whole different variety of termite species and asking different questions about them, sometimes about their genetics or their evolution or their behavior. To me, that's been a great fit with interests and opportunities, and I've loved it.
All those things, when it fits in that realm, it's not uncommon for people to look at basic research, and if you're not in that game, if you're not playing that game, you don't always see why you'd want to play that game. You know, why are they doing that? What's the benefit? And many times, you know, humans, we have a tendency to think everything has got to be all about us, right? In this case, not only do you do the basic research, but that basic research has actually turned into some very important things for us. And this comes back to you were talking about earlier about, well, we like these termites. We need the termites. Matter of fact, without termites, we'd be in deep trouble, even if we'd be here. But we don't necessarily want them in our house.
Absolutely.
So in this realm, you actually hold some patents, I've heard. And so with patents, people think business. Have you seen your science and business kind of crossing paths?
Yeah, and I think that's another avenue that science can take people when they don't even expect it. So in my case, for example, It used to be that the way that people controlled termites around houses was to spray all sorts of nasty pesticide on them. And that put pesticide around homes, and that was a very persistent pesticide, and so kind of dangerous. And that was taken off the market. And so all of a sudden, there weren't the tools to protect homes from termites. And, you know, we as humans, we build our houses out of termite food, wood. So, of course, we want to keep the termites happy in the forest or in the desert or whatever their normal habitat, but not in our homes. So that was at a point that I had begun my termite studies so that I really was learning about the biology of the insect. And when we now needed to create new ways to detect them, to manage them, to prevent them getting into houses, to control them, I won't say I could think like a termite, but I could kind of psych out how they would behave in a certain situation or foods they would like to eat or types of homes they were more likely to infest. And so working with a colleague of mine, James Trinello at Boston University, our goal was to develop an approach for managing termites that would be less reliant on widely broadcast pesticide and specifically target the termites. So we developed what's called a termite bait that is sort of like a cookie that termites can't resist. If they bump into it, they want to eat it. We laced that cookie with a pesticide that really only the termites would eat because they're the ones that would encounter the cookie, and there aren't too many things that eat the kind of cookies termites like that are made out of dead wood. And so the principle was that some of the termites in the colony would come and feed at the cookie and then pass along the pesticide to their friends in the colony. And at least for ones that were eating a house, they would then go away.
So how many patents do you have?
I have 3 termite ones and one other one.
All right.
Yeah. So it is a way that if you're, again, you're developing new ideas as a scientist and potentially new technologies, and there may be ways to apply it in ways you didn't even think of when you first started the study. But I think it's a good thing for all of scientists to do to, one, communicate their work and learn how to tell people what they're doing that doesn't sound like just some narrow, narrow study of scales of snakes or whatever. And, you know, why is it important, or what can you learn from that system that then you could apply to a different system? So communicating is very, very important, explaining what you're doing, and then also thinking about applications that might help people.
When you were talking today, there was a word that you used. It was actually in your title. And although we don't use, this isn't a big word, it's not very long, but it's a word that a lot of people don't hear, eusocial. Can you talk just a little bit about eusocial?
Okay, well, eusocial, it basically means highly social. So if you're just social, like humans, we're social, right? We do Facebook, we do, you know, kind of...
Well, there's Twitter out there.
Love being with each other, parties. You want to be alone at some points, but you like company. And monkeys and wolves and lions and many things are social in that they live in groups or families. But eusocial is amping it up one more notch and a higher level of sociality. And it's a term that is restricted for extreme cases like the social insects, which many of them are not only social but eusocial. So a honeybee, for example, with the queen and the workers. And so there are 3 characteristics that if a group of animals has all 3 of them, they have to have all 3 of them, then they're considered eusocial. And one of them is overlapping generations. So the moms and the offspring have to be alive at the same time, or the grandmother and the mom and the offspring. So the queen honeybee and her offspring are alive at the same time. So that's overlapping generations. And then something called cooperative brood care, which means they all help. They pitch in to help with the nursery to raise the offspring. And then the final one is the big, tough angle that not too many animals have. And it's, again, this one coming back to Darwin that was the tough spot for him. And that is what's called reproductive division of labor, meaning that everybody in the colony does not reproduce. And there can be a spectrum. So there are certain ones, like the queen honeybee, she does the reproduction. She produces all of the eggs, or most of them. And then all the workers in the colony are, for the most part, sterile. So that extreme difference, called reproductive division of labor.
So with humans, we could say you could do 2 out of 3, maybe?
Yeah. Yeah, we might do 2 out of 3. And a lot of animals are in that boat. They did the 2 easy ones. Well, easier. But that really restrictive one, it limits it to a very few animals, but quite diverse animals. So in addition to the social insects that we always think of, there's a mammal called the naked mole rat that lives in Africa. There are some really cool shrimp, snapping shrimp, that live on the coast of Central America. I mean, those are pretty diverse. Insects, mammal, shrimp, all of which have this organization of a queen and many workers that help out but don't reproduce. I think if Darwin had known about the shrimp and the naked mole rat, not much was known at that time. Very, very exciting.
When you were talking about the termites, you actually mentioned how long they live. And 18 to 20 years is one of the lengths of time that was in my notes right now. When most insects, or a lot of insects, are measured their lifespan in days, that seems like a really, really, really long time. Is that really long even for eusocial types of insects or eusocial types of animals?
Yeah, well, that's a very good question. So one feature of these highly social or eusocial insects is that the reproductives, the queens, for example, do tend to live a long time compared to most other insects. So when you think of a butterfly, for example, they are hatched out of the egg and they do their little thing as a caterpillar for a couple of weeks and they go into their pupa and they emerge from the chrysalis as a beautiful butterfly and they fly around and mate and eat and then they die. So they're relatively short-lived. And some social insect workers may be as well. We don't really know because it's hard to age them in the field. But we do know that the reproductives, the queens, and in the case of the termites, the kings too, live for many years, or can. And the example that you just mentioned, 18 to 20 years, those are known measurements that we did in our lab of termite royal pairs, the king and the queen, that we put together, and then we find them again alive, healthy, thriving with their colony 2 decades later, and potentially they could live even longer. Now, not all social insects and not all termites, even the queens, live that long, but that's on the extreme side.
Still impressive to me.
Very impressive.
I have a new respect for the termite.
Termites do get a bad rap as a nasty reputation for eating houses, but remember, tropical rainforests would not exist without termites, and they're really interesting with their kings and queens and colony organizations. So.
And I would say for those that say, okay, so what? If we don't have tropical rainforests, we don't need those, no big deal. I want you to go out there and do some homework. Find out what would happen, hypothetically, if we have no tropical rainforests, because I think you're going to find a very interesting story and one that maybe will get you thinking about these green machines, these termites, wow, we really owe our lives to them. So on Ask a Biologist, we always ask our guests 3 questions. So the first question is, when did you first know you wanted to be a scientist or a biologist?
So that's actually a good story with me. I absolutely did not want to be a scientist. I did not like science in elementary school, junior high, or high school. With a passion, I didn't like it so much that I went to a college that I chose because I wouldn't have to take science.
Really?
I thought. Yes. And got there, and they made the very good point that to be an educated person, you need to explore lots of different things and be exposed to and learn how to think and so forth, all sorts of knowledge. And so I took a couple of science courses just as exploratory. And loved it. The first course I took was called The Earth, Moon, and Mars. The things that I loved about science were the logic and the precision and then the excitement of new discovery. And once I was hooked, then I, for various reasons, sort of navigated to biology and then into genetics and bugs as systems to look at. And then I read a book on insect societies, and that got me hooked on social insects and termites.
Was this the book by Ed Wilson?
It was, yes. Yeah. So I say I'm a case where I didn't know from early on that I wanted to be a scientist, but I think I hadn't really given it a fair shot. And sometimes, you know, I think all of us have had teachers that haven't been very inspiring, and they were boring, and they were whatever. And so if you're out there and you're dealing with that kind of a situation where it just hasn't gotten hooked on science, go read something you're interested in. Forget what the teacher's talking about or your class is covering, you know, volcanoes or something that does or doesn't interest you. Just go and read about something that really is of interest to you and see if that makes it a little more exciting and go in that direction, sir.
Okay, so I know how you got started. I'm going to take it all away. You can't be a scientist of any kind, and most of my scientists love teaching too. So I want you to stretch, so I'm going to take that away from you. And I'm going to give you the gift of whatever you want to do, you get to do. It's not as if you think you would be able to do it. What would you be or what would you do?
Wow, that's a very difficult question. If you asked me that about what other direction in science I'd want to go, I could tell you. But wow, for a field. Well, I do like writing. Maybe I would have done that. But to be fair, perhaps I didn't know about enough. I didn't give other fields a chance either. I mean, there's many, many exciting directions to go. But for me personally, the way I think, the way I like to discover new things, science is a very good fit for me.
And if you went into another field of science, I'll let you answer that one.
Yeah, well, I think that what changes there is that there are new developments all the time and new technologies. And so you can ask questions that you couldn't have asked years ago. So to me now, the fields of genomics, looking at genes, really getting down and dirty and actually seeing what we're all made of and the variation there is just and how it's all controlled, that's very exciting. And then I think many dimensions of neurobiology and all the connections now that are possible by merging different fields of science. So, you know, biomechanics and computational biology.
Yeah, the bioinformatics, you know, large numbers. Yep, we have a whole new world that's just opening up to us.
Yeah, so there's sort of no barriers anymore, and that's a good thing.
My last question. What advice would you have for an up-and-coming scientist-to-be?
That the big thing is keep asking questions. Just ask questions and don't think that's a stupid question or a dumb question or it's obvious or whatever. Just keep thinking of new questions and follow things that are exciting to you. So follow your passion. And then the other advice I'd have is be nice to people. Treat people well because you're opportunities to a large degree are going to depend on people wanting to mentor you. And if you're a classy, solid, honest, hardworking person, you're going to be getting lots of opportunities and people are going to want to invest in you.
Well, Barbara Thorne, thanks again. I really appreciate you being on Ask a Biologist.
Thanks, Dr. Biology.
You've been listening to Ask a Biologist, and my guest has been Barbara Thorne, professor and director of the Biological Sciences Graduate Program at the University of Maryland. The Ask a Biologist podcast is produced on the campus of Arizona State University and is recorded in the Grassroots Studio, housed in the School of Life Sciences, which is a division of the College of Liberal Arts and Sciences. And remember, even though our program is not broadcast live, you can still send us your questions about biology using our companion website. The address is askabiologist.asu.edu. Or you can just Google the words, Ask a Biologist. I'm Dr. Biology.